This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
So if you watch the Hulu documentary about the Adelsons and you're here now going, I want to learn more, well, welcome to the fourth part in our series as we break down all of the Adelsons and their lovely ways. If you're just joining us, like I said, this is part four. We've already covered Donna. We've covered Harvey. We've covered Charlie. And the dynamics of the other folks in this, including Catherine McBanua and the hitman Sigfrido Garcia, all of that. We've hit it all. Now we're up to the actual woman who benefited most from the decisions that her family made poorly. And the big question has been for so many years, what did she know? The answer might be nothing. What did Wendy know about her family plotting to end the life of her ex-husband, the father of her children, the father of the grandchildren, the father of the niece and the nephew of these people that have been convicted of taking his life so they could have more access to the kids? So that worked out well, didn't it? Wendy certainly got more access in this whole process. Didn't quite work out as good for everybody else, though. So, is this a story where the family way oversteps their bounds because they have no boundaries and did what they wanted to do despite Wendy saying,
maybe it's not a good idea to kill my husband. I don't know. I don't think it's a nice idea. I don't think you should do that. That's just, yeah, Jackie.
I don't know. I have no idea. But I mean, judging by Wendy's demeanor in court, I'm thinking that maybe how it could have gone. Hey, we're thinking of killing your husband, your ex-husband.
Come on.
Rather than no. What on earth are you thinking? That's insane.
Oh, God. Guys, I know you love me so much.
Again, I have no idea what happened, but judging by the enmeshed family of the Adelsons, that's probably not a far cry from reality, in my opinion. But again, Wendy's never been charged with anything. She's maintaining her innocence. There is one sentence of the Dan Markell case that has now been repeated in courtroom after courtroom, and nobody can play the recording because the recording does not exist. Jeffrey Lacasse says Wendy Adelson said it to him 5 days before Dan was shot. According to Lacasse, Wendy asked whether she could tell him something confidential. Then she told him that her brother, Charlie, looked into every option for dealing with the Danny Markell problem, including hiring a hitman that would cost about $15,000. Now, why you tell your boyfriend this in confidence is beyond me. Make the love bond that much stronger when you're going at it. It's like, oh, she told me about how, or I told him how we might hire a hitman. Oh, we're so much closer. I don't know. I don't think that's necessarily the link, but I do think it's the talking, the sharing of information in very much the same way that a 7-year-old little girl would share a secret. Just can't hold it in. It's just too much. And I better, because Wendy, in a lot of ways, as educated as she is, as intelligent as she is, emotionally, I think some may argue, maybe a little stunted. Not that it's, not saying a fault of her own. Again, this is all conjecture. I don't know if she's stunted or not, but judging by the reactions in this case and what we've seen publicly, one may come to that conclusion. I'm going, yeah, wow. Your mom's hiring the TV repairman. Your parents do so much damn shit for you. You're a grown-ass adult with your own children, and you're still being treated like you're about 10. That may stunt someone. That may make someone be able to function over here as an adult. And over here, still as if, you know, Disney afternoon's coming on. It's time to have a granola bar and watch Tailspin. or DuckTales, or Darkwing Duck, or Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers. I know my fucking Disney afternoon from 1993, goddammit. According to Lacoste, Wendy asked whether she could tell him something confidential. Confidential.
Danny Markell, $15,000.
Lacoste, he called that conversation chilling. He said it made his stomach flip. Wouldn't it, you? With this girl? Family's a little nutty, a little bit extreme. They're talking about her and a hitman. Yeah. Wendy has denied saying it. She's denied knowing that Dan was going to be killed. She's denied helping anyone carry it out. And as of now, she's never been charged with a crime connected to Dan's death. So let's be very clear about where this story begins. Not with a proven confession, not with a recording, and not with a charge. It begins with two people describing the same private conversation in ways that cannot both be accurate. That's what makes Wendy Adelson different from everybody else in this case. Siegfriedo Garcia, Catherine McBonnet, Charlie Adelson, and Donna Adelson were all convicted. Luis Rivera pled guilty and testified for the state. Each has either been convicted by a jury or admitted guilt in court. Wendy has not. Prosecutors have called her a conspirator in court, but they have not put that allegation into the indictment. Wendy has repeatedly said they are wrong. And that line matters. A courtroom cannot transfer guilt through a family tree, no matter how many relatives have been convicted. But those of us on the outside, we can read the tea leaves. But being uncharged does not make the surrounding facts disappear. It means we have to discuss them without pretending the unanswered question has already been answered. LaCaye stated Wendy during 2013 and 2014 when her divorce and custody fight with Dan dominated much of her life. He testified that the case was a constant topic of conversation and described the Adelsons as a family without boundaries. He also spent time around Charlie. During a South Florida visit, LaCaye had dinner with Charlie and Catherine McBanua. Later, according to LaCaye, Charlie bragged that he knew people on both sides of the tracks. I'm the dentist everybody wants to know because I know the folks on this side of the track and the folks on that side of the track. I do fillings for each. Tight. Doctors and dentists. One side, people connected to the criminal world. On the other, Charlie after dark, if you will. That's for Charlie. We don't want to see that side of Charlie when he goes to that side of the tracks. Because Charlie becomes the wild and crazy dentist at that point. Woo! That comment did not prove Charlie was arranging anything. People brag, people exaggerate. Some men can turn one dinner into a one-person podcast about how connected and dangerous they are. But 4 months later, Dan was shot by a man linked to Charlie through McBanua. Suddenly, the bragging did not sound quite as decorative. Then came the conversation LaCaye says happened 5 days before the shooting. LaCaye did not say when he told him Charlie had begun shopping for a hitman that week. He recalled her saying Charlie had explored those options the previous summer. You're shopping for a new sweater at Dillard's. I'm exploring my options over here. Oh, what's at the fragrance counter? What's new over here? I'm exploring the options. Hitman, $15,000. Is that a deal? Or is that a ripoff, considering how things didn't work out all that well? Maybe if you're going to knock somebody, I don't know what it costs to hire a hitman, but I mean, judging from the stories that we hear on this program, the going rate seems to be around $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 a hit from the hitmen that end up being talked about on this show. They end up being talked about on the show because things don't go so well. So I'm thinking if you're in the market for a hitman, you better go above the bargain basement 10, 15 G ones because they don't seem to go down all that smoothly. I'm thinking maybe you want to go to the bigger tier. Maybe not the Walmart level hitmen. Maybe go to the Target level. Maybe just take it up a step. Go to the ones maybe 30, 40,000. Maybe they cross their T's and dot their I's a little smoother. I don't know. But if you're trying to make an educated guess based on the stories we talk about that have hitmen in them, if you're paying around 10 to 15 or anything below, your odds of ending up on this program dramatically increase. Just saying. Charlie had explored those options the previous summer. Still, she allegedly brought it up days before Dan was attacked in the middle of collapsing the relationship while discussing a custody conflict. Again, Wendy says the conversation never happened. Jeff Lacoste says they're talking about custody. They're talking about the family, their relationship falling apart. It's rough. And by the way, my brother might be hiring a hitman. He explored the options. There's no clean way around that conflict. If Lacoste remembered it accurately, Wendy knew her brother had at least discussed hiring someone to kill Dan long before police ever questioned her. If Wendy is telling the truth, then Lacoste attached an extraordinarily damaging statement to the conversation that never contained it. That's not a disagreement over tone. That is the Grand Canyon with two people standing on opposite sides pointing at each other. The timing became even more uncomfortable when Lacoste described what happened next. He testified that Wendy asked detailed questions about his drive to Tallahassee on Friday, July 18th, including when he planned to leave and which route he would take. Lacoste says that route could have taken him past Dan's neighborhood around the same time of the shooting. Interesting to want to know when you're going to be passing by the scene of a crime that you know nothing about, days before it occurs. That might be, I don't know. I don't know anything about this, but my boyfriend was over. Oh my gosh, is my boyfriend doing this to pretend? Ah! That might have been the plan. Just never quite worked out that way. Never quite got far enough down the road of madness to, attempt to cast that dispersion over to Mr. Lacoste. Lacoste drove a gray Nissan Sentra at Donna's trial. He compared it to gray Nissan Altima Garcia and Rivera had rented during an earlier Tallahassee trip. But the car used on July 18th was a rented green Toyota Prius, so this was not a clean same car match. Lacoste eventually told investigators he believed Wendy may have been trying to make him look like an alternative suspect. That was his interpretation. No public evidence, other than what we've talked about, establishes that Wendy planted physical evidence, directed police towards him, or manufactured a record tying him to the shooting. And that's important, but as everything in this case goes, objects in the rearview mirror may be closer than they appear. That's not that close. It actually is. But the questions bothered him because of the alleged hitman conversation and because the relationship was breaking apart at exactly the same time. Could a girlfriend ask him about a boyfriend's travel route? For completely innocent reasons, of course. Could the same questions look different after her former husband is killed on the date being discussed? Obviously. That's the problem throughout Wendy's story. Almost every suspicious detail comes with a possible innocent explanation. The explanations are not impossible. They just keep arriving exactly when needed. Take the television. Charlie had bought Wendy a television as a divorce gift, like one does. He admitted making the grotesque joke that the television was cheaper than hiring a hitman. Wendy called it a tasteless joke. Charlie later called it one of the stupidest things he's ever said. And look, on the surface, people make tasteless jokes. People make inappropriate jokes all the time. I happen to be one of them. So when I heard that, I'm like, people say stupid shit, especially when you're going through a very dramatic phase of life. One may go to extremes in their joking to make light. Again, I do it all the time. It's not that I'm ever doing anything. I know that. But it looks incredibly suspicious when you actually were seriously looking into such things and then joking about them. That takes it a little far beyond, let's say, something extreme and get a reaction to. Let's say something extreme. I was actually studying this, looking it up, and considering my options, and now I'm just going to kind of throw it in here. As I buy you a TV. TV that seemingly is going to need to be repaired. From a repair that, if we understand correctly, is an irreparable device. Because if you remember correctly, and I'm trying to remember correctly as I'm talking about this, so take it for what it's worth with conjecture. The television, from what we understand, something had hit it. Something had, and as we all know, modern televisions that have a big hit in it, crack in it, somebody pushes on the screen too hard, it breaks the screen. You're screwed. There's no fixing that device. It's broken. You have to go buy a new one. TVs are cheap these days, so people just replace them and you don't repair it. A common sense observation of the television, based on some of the testimony from Wendy's ex-boyfriend, would have told you, don't call a repairman. There's nothing you can fix on this damn thing. It is broken. So the premise of calling the repairman, which Donna did, not Wendy, which I find a little odd, that by itself, I apologize, it's allergy season. And somebody said, I'm going to buy you Zyrtec. I already take Allegra and Mucinex. Might as well add it to the link, or add it to the list, if you will, of things I'm taking. Even the TV seems a little bit too perfectly set up. Like, why are you getting this TV as a divorce present? Why is it suddenly broken? Why is it an obvious thing that if it's it's a problem with it the way it is broken, that it's clearly not fixable by a repairman showing up? Maybe Wendy's just that stupid. Maybe Donna's that stupid. I mean, Donna did allegedly launder money in a washing machine. So I don't know. Maybe the assumption I'm making of the TV is broken and clearly broken and not fixable is too much of an assumption that the nitwits in the Adelson family would understand that this is not a fixable television. I don't know. Maybe I am thinking too much into that one. Could be. Either way, it is a red flag. On the morning Dan was shot, Wendy was at home waiting for the Geek Squad technician to repair the television that Donna scheduled. Donna called it in. For her 30-some-year-old adult daughter with children, grandma's calling Best Buy's Geek Squad for a television that's not even in her house. Again, weird. Weird. Could it be Donna and Charlie going, keep Wendy over here? She's got the appointment. I could hear it.
Charlie, this is Donna. We're going to get Geek Squad involved. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good, Ma.
We're going to get Geek Squad involved. I have my friends over at the Best Buy and they are going to come and they're going to fix her TV, and Wendy's not going to know any better. She's going to sit at home. And she's going to watch the TV be fixed while we take care of the problem.
Something like that. I don't know. And Winnie might have been like, okay, Mom, whatever you say. Can you bring me a fruit roll-up? A broken television is not an alibi conspiracy. Mothers schedule service calls for adult children every day, unfortunately, because they don't allow their children to grow up and to be grown-ass adults, especially mothers who treat adulthood as a customer service problem. Prosecutors argued that references to the television became coded language inside the family and that the repair appointment helped establish where Wendy would be that morning. Wendy decided that TV meant murder or that the appointment was anything other than an ordinary repair. Wendy denied that any of that was what it meant. That's the allegations. It's all code word. Wendy's like, nope, I don't think so. Then there's Trescott Drive. After the shooting, but before police told her what had happened, Wendy drove towards the street where Dan lived. She testified that she was headed to a liquor store to buy bourbon for lunch and try to use Trescott as part of the route. Gotta get my bourbon. Well, that's your mom, Wendy. I don't fucking blame you. The road was blocked with crime scene tape, so she turned around. She said she did not know the police activity involved Dan. Again, weird moment in this case where there's police tape around your ex-husband's house, where your children also happen to be, and you're like, yeah, liquor store. Floor it. People sometimes talk about that drive as though the road itself convicts her. It doesn't. An innocent person could take that route. Person checking whether something had happened could take that route, too. The car cannot tell us which thought was inside the driver's head. What makes that drive relevant is the timing, the destination, and the alleged conversation with Lacoste. Relevant does not mean conclusive. It means the drive belongs to the same timeline as everything else. And then Wendy did something that does not fit the cartoon version of a guilty mastermind, quietly hiding behind lawyers. She went with police and sat through a long recorded interview without an attorney. She talked a lot. She acknowledged that police would naturally look at the ex-wife. She mentioned her parents' hostility towards Dan. She brought up Charlie's hitman joke. I mean, Wendy did everything a passive-aggressive bitch would do who doesn't want any blame coming on her. Oh, my gosh. Do you think it could be Charlie? He joked about a hitman. Oh! Like mother, like daughter. The let me sprinkle little things over here so your attention goes away from me. Although, who knows? Maybe she was just, you know, that stupid. That unaware of what's going on. Maybe she knew how insulated she was, that she could go to the cops and she could play innocent and she could play foolish and stupid and have no idea what's going on because her family had insulated her so much that there was nothing that anyone was going to find on Wendy because Wendy truly had nothing to do with this. She was just close enough to know there's a raging inferno in the next room. Who's going, there's smoke over there. Nah. It'll burn itself out. And she's right, it did. But again, all conjecture. She agreed to fingerprinting, a gunshot residue test, and searches of her phone and computer, according to her testimony. That cooperation matters. It supports the argument that Wendy behaved like a shocked former spouse, not somebody trying to shut down questioning. Prosecutors see the interview differently. They have suggested that Wendy placed the hitman joke and her family's anger into the conversation in a rather controlled way, giving police a version that sounded canon while keeping any alleged advanced knowledge out of it. The consequences to those involved in it be damned. Maybe that's what happened. Maybe she was simply in shock and saying everything that crossed her mind. The recording gives us her words. It does not give us a reliable scan on her intent. After Dan's death, Wendy moved the boys to South Florida. She later changed her surnames from Markell to Adelson right after he was killed. You know, like you do. Hey, Dad's dead. How should we remember him? We're going to hold his name close to our heart for the rest of our lives. Nope, we're going to change it because Grandma wants it different. We're going to wipe him away. Those decisions remain deeply painful to Dan's parents and have become part of the public suspicion surrounding her. But receiving the outcome your family wanted does not prove you joined the plan that produced it. That point cannot be skipped. Motive can explain conduct. Benefit can explain motive. Neither one by itself establishes agreement. Still, the outcome is impossible to ignore. The court had refused to let Wendy relocate the children. Dan's death removed the legal obstacle. She moved south. The children grew up there. The life Donna had fought for became a reality temporarily. Then there was the dinner. A few weeks after Dan was killed, Wendy and Charlie had dinner together. Wendy and Lacoste agree the dinner happened. The testimony established that Wendy became sick during it. They disagree about what that dinner actually meant. Lacoste testified that Wendy told him Charlie called it a celebratory dinner. Wendy denied that description and said she was unhappy and grieving. The defense attacked Lacoste's interpretation and account. Once again, no recording, two accounts, one detail that lands very differently depending on who you're actually believing. People split into camps here. One side says the pattern makes the absence of charges absurd. The other says each fact has an innocent explanation magnified by years of headlines and family association. The honest answer is less satisfying than either side wants. The public record gives prosecutors questions. It does not tell us whether they believe they have a chargeable case. The delay could reflect evidence problems, immunity, witness limitations, strategy, or facts the public has never seen. There is no charging document to answer it. Wendy testified under subpoena. With use and derivative use immunity, in plain English, prosecutors generally cannot use her compelled testimony or evidence found because of it to build a case against her. Independently obtained evidence remains available. Immaterially false testimony can support perjury. The internet version says one lie detonates the arrangement. It doesn't. Prosecutors would still have to trace their evidence to an independent source and prove every element. That is why Lacoste's account matters and still may not be enough. It establishes what he says he heard. Without a recording or direct corroboration, a jury would have to decide which person accurately remembers private conversations from 2014. That leaves Wendy at the center of the motive. Surrounded by convicted relatives, repeatedly questioned under oath, publicly called a conspirator by prosecutors, and still uncharged. It's not public clearance, and it is nowhere near a conviction. A mound of suspicion does not become a charging document because the internet stacks it high enough. We do not have to choose between pretending a pattern means nothing and calling it a verdict. The pattern explains the questions. The burden of proof explains why no courtroom has answered them. None of these facts exist alone. Not the alleged hitman conversation, Lacoste's route, the television, Trescott Drive, the police interview, and the move south. The name change or the disputed dinner. Everyone has an explanation. The problem is that every explanation arrives on schedule. That does not make Wendy Adelson guilty. It explains why, 12 years after Dan Markell was shot, the biggest unanswered question in this case is still the one no jury has been asked to decide. Your thoughts in the comment section and Substack and YouTube. We will continue our conversation right there. Love for you to weigh in. And, not done so yet, subscribe to the podcast. The link is right there. The QR code is on the screen if you're watching us on YouTube. If you're not there, just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi wherever you get podcasts and press subscribe. We do appreciate that. Until next time, my name's Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.